Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscawain. In 1813, Jane Austen published Pride and Prejudice under the pseudonym A Lady. In the two centuries since, the love story of witty, intelligent Elizabeth Bennet and proud and difficult Mr. Darcy has captivated millions of readers and viewers of the many television and film adaptations. But the book is more than just a romance. One of our guests today suggests it's a commentary on the changing political landscape of Jane Austen's England. This hour, we celebrate Pride and Prejudice's 200th anniversary and Jane Austen's writing and her life. Our guests are Colleen Sheehan and Deborah Yaffe. Sheehan is an Austen scholar and professor of politics at Villanova University, and Deborah Yaffe is a journalist, and she profiled hardcore Austen devotees in her book, Among the Janeites, A Journey Through the World of Jane Austen Fans. Deborah, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Colleen Sheehan, welcome to Radio Times.
Good to be here.
And of course, we want to hear from all you Jane Austen fans out there. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. And we're also using Twitter this hour because we expect a lot of chatter, civilized, albeit. So you can tweet us at Radio WHYY Radio Times. Again, that's at WHYY Radio Times. Use the hashtag Jane Austen. Let me ask both of you, Deborah, let me start with you. How and when did you fall in love with Jane Austen's writing?
Well, I actually know this exactly because when I was researching the book, I went and looked at my diaries from when I was a little girl, and I found the diary that I kept the summer that I was 10, and that is when I first read Pride and Prejudice. We were on a family.
10.
Yeah, I was a precocious reader, and we were on a family vacation. I had read every single book I brought with me. My father was an English professor, and he bought this book for me and brought it home and said, "You might want to try this." And That was the beginning, and the rest was history, as they say.
What spoke to you as a 10-year-old girl about that book?
You know, I wish I could remember, but I actually can't. I never wrote in my diary anything very instructive about what I thought about what I read. I just wrote everything that I read. So I don't really know, but I know that at that age, I was just really interested in stories and characters. And even though there's a lot more going on in Jane Austen, you can always relate to her just on that basic level of how fun it is to find out what's going to happen to these people.
And Colleen Sheehan, let me ask you the same thing. When did you discover Jane Austen?
Well, compared to Deborah, I guess I was a latecomer. I discovered Pride and Prejudice when I was 14. My aunt and uncle, my aunt was a English teacher. I lived in a family. My dad had to drop out of school when he was in eighth grade because it was Depression. And so we didn't have a lot of books in my house. And I was at my aunt and uncle's house, and she had a few of her literature books displayed. And she said I could borrow them from time to time if I wanted to read them. So one of the ones I borrowed was Pride and Prejudice, and I loved it. And then a number of years later, when I first started graduate school and had no furniture, and I would go to yard sales, could I find just a little something incredibly cheap to use as a nightstand? And they would always have those books in a box for like a dollar each. And they had the complete novels of Jane Austen for a dollar. So I took it home. I started reading another one of the novels and never put it down. And read all six novels and then started them again.
And what drew you to Pride and Prejudice? What were some of the themes that spoke to you? And continue to speak to you, obviously.
Yeah. I think Jane Austen has an uncanny insight into human nature. Wouldn't you love to sit with her at an airport and just observe people? She has, her perception is as sharp as any novelist I think I've ever read. I think it's as sharp as Shakespeare. And she has something to say about us all. But she makes us sort of pull it out a little bit. She's not blunt. She's very nuanced. And so she has a high art of describing to us who we are or making us see ourselves in such a way that we want to be perhaps a little bit more like Elizabeth and maybe a little bit less like Wickham.
What's your take, Deborah?
No, Jaffe? I think that's exactly right. She is an unparalleled observer, but she doesn't tell you what to think about what she observes. So she makes you as the reader become involved in the process of figuring out who these characters are and why some of them are admirable and some of them aren't. And that ideally involves you in a process of self-examination as well, thinking about whether you want to be the kind of person that you are, whether some aspects of your personality are uncomfortably close to the characters that you are being shown as not very admirable.
What do we know? Talk a bit about who was Jane Austen. How did she live? What was her life like? Colleen Sheehan, do you want to start?
Well, you know, she never married. and there's lots of speculation about whether there was, you know, a love in her life and so on. You've seen probably some of these recent movies. She led a quiet life with her family. She had a sister whom she adored. She and Cassandra were incredibly close. She had brothers. A couple of the younger ones were in the Navy, so therefore maybe, you know, she was thinking of them when she talked about Wentworth and Persuasion. I don't think London was her favorite place. She preferred the countryside, and you can see that in her novels. You see that exchange between Mrs. Bennet and Mr. Darcy about whether the town or the country is superior. I think she was a woman who led a very quiet life, but an incredibly exciting life, because she lived in the world of her imagination, and her imagination was as rich as anyone's.
Deborah? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to remember that she was the child of a clergyman. She grew up in an extremely, in a world in which religion was taken for granted and certain moral values were taken for granted by all the people that she lived with. She didn't live in a world like ours where a lot of things are up for grabs. But she nevertheless wrote books that are not doctrinaire and preachy. And I think that's kind of interesting, that she came from a place of real moral centeredness, but managed to see human complexity and convey that to us.
And talk about the times she lived in, what was happening politically, what was happening on a level of class and society.
Yeah, I mean, Jane Austen lived in the time when the world went through probably the greatest transition that has ever occurred. I mean, this is the time when Montesquieu writes about this just a little bit earlier, and he sees in his book Spirit of the Laws in 1748 that the face of the world is absolutely changing because industrialization is just beginning. And so that means things like, I mean, who had access to books all through human history? You know, you had to be pretty much a priest or a part of the aristocracy to be educated. And so the printing press is developed sometime earlier, but now it's chugging along. There's such a thing developing as what we now call the public. aristocracy, kingship, despotism, oligarchy, that had been the way of the world for the most part. There's a rising middle class for the first time in human history. I mean, that's what the gardeners represent in Pride and Prejudice. They're tradespeople. Could tradespeople be respectable? Well, Elizabeth loves her aunt and uncle gardener, and the reader comes to love them too. They can, in fact, not only become respectable, they can be welcomed at Pemberley. And unlike what Lady Catherine de Bourgh would say, remember, to Elizabeth, that the, would you so pollute the shades of Pemberley, you know, with your family and relations? Well, in fact, the shades of Pemberley will be elevated by the presence of the gardeners. Mm-hmm. And this is what's going on in the world. The old aristocracy is dying out. They don't have much money. The best they're going to be able to do, and if you travel to some parts of Ireland today, you will actually find the old aristocracy renting out their rooms in their old mansions. And the best it is a shabby chic.
Mm-hmm. That's Colleen Sheehan. She is a scholar of Jane Austen. She's also a professor of politics at Villanova University. We're also joined in the studio by Deborah Yaffe. She has a new book called Among the Janeites about Jane Austen fans. And we are talking today about Jane Austen. Our hook, so to speak, is the 200th anniversary of Pride and Prejudice, one of the best loved, if there is such a thing, of Jane Austen novels, among them all. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-7777. 9499. Talk about what you love about the book, how you discovered it, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us how you fell in love with Jane Austen and maybe what your favorite quote is from Pride and Prejudice, how you discovered that book. So, Colleen, just to go back to the point you were just making, so Pride and Prejudice, often we think of it as a bonnet book or a book about ladies and love and husbands, but you see it more as a commentary of the times, of the changing world.
Well, I think it is about love and friendship mm-hmm. as well, which are not silly things. And Jane Austen certainly understood what it meant to be a good friend. So it is about those things. But it's also, I mean, there are layers to it. It's mm-hmm. like an onion that you can peel away. It's a complex novel. And it's worth rereading twice, thrice, and even more, because each time I reread, I discover new things.
Oh, always, yeah. You don't have to choose among all of those things that it's about. You get them all at once. That's yeah. why it's such a wonderful gift, because you get the romance and you also get all these deeper things going on.
And it seems like the characters represent, the characters in the people in the book represent character traits. So you spoke about the gardeners and their role as tradespeople, but who are very good and decent people. What are some of the other characters and what do they represent to you?
Well, I think many, many readers, male and female, identify very strongly with Elizabeth Bennet because she's the person who has such a strong sense of self that she's never afraid to say what she thinks. And that's a trait a lot of us wish we had and don't have, I think. So we see her as sort of an idealized version of who we would like to be. She's the person who stands up to the wealthy woman, Lady Catherine, and says, I have a right to dignity and privacy, and just because you want me to bend before your superior rank, I'm not going to do it. And so I am guessing that Colleen will say that that represents something about a new democratic spirit and the rise of a different kind of class consciousness among people who had previously thought of themselves as being by birth inferior to others who were superior by birth.
Do you?
Well, I think you said it very well.
You're all too civil. I should have known.
That's right.
To Jane Austen fans.
Jane Austen fans won't fight. There you go.
That's right.
Not so, as you'll know if you read my book.
Well, and there are other characters in the novel, such as Wickham, that at first we think, because we tend to see things through the eyes of Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. At first we think, I mean, he is handsome, he's charming, he wears a uniform.
And we think he's a good guy.
And we think he's a good guy, and we think Darcy, because we have Wickham's account of this, is a proud, insufferable man who's mistreated. Right.
Darcy behaves badly as well.
Yeah, and it's debatable whether what he does is a matter of false pride. Or not. So, I mean, mm-hmm. this is a fun thing that people who read the novel debate about. But Wickham, of course, turns out to be a mercenary. He just wants to get what he can. He runs away with Elizabeth's younger sister, Lydia, and almost destroys the entire Bennet family. And if it isn't for Darcy, he would have, because mm-hmm. in that day and age, you know, you can't be an unmarried woman living with somebody in Gretna mm-hmm. Green.
Oh, yeah.
And it destroys not only you, but your entire family. And so there are all these different characters, and we're to judge their actions.
And what does Wickham, which class does he represent to you, or who is he kind of in the book?
Well, his father was a steward of old Mr. Darcy. And so he's part of the working class, but he was treated very well by Darcy's father. So he's up and coming, but he's the other side of the gardeners because he misuses it.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking about Jane Austen and also about the 200th anniversary of Pride and Prejudice. We'll be right back here on Radio Times after a short break.
Delaware Theater Company presents the 2010 Barrymore Award winner for Best Play, Any Given Monday, now through the 22nd. A comedy about the curveballs life throws at you, Any Given Monday asks how far is too far when a family tries to get back on track to happily ever after. Starring Lucy DeVito, Leslie Hendricks, Kenny Morris, and Michael Mastro. For tickets, 302-594-1100 or online at DelawareTheater.org. The Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Next time on Here and Now, scientists are trying to unravel the mystery of starfish dying off along the East Coast.
I collected about 10 sea stars from the bay, and I put them into the tank, and within 5 days to a week, they had literally just melted apart.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Aspiring nonprofit leaders can get both the skills and credentials they need for advancement by earning a certificate from the Nonprofit Center at LaSalle University's School of Business. Certificate programs can be completed in 8 months and include nonprofit management, fundraising, finance, marketing and communications, or a build-your-own certificate. Course descriptions, packages, and schedules are available at 215-951-1701 or online at LaSalleNonprofitCenter.org. The Nonprofit Center supports WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. We are talking about the 200th birthday of Pride and Prejudice, about the enduring legacy of Jane Austen. With us in the studio is Deborah Yaffe. She's a journalist and has a new book called Among the Jane Knights, about ardent Jane Austen fans. And also Colleen Sheehan. She is an Austen scholar and a professor of politics at Villanova University, where she also directs the Ryan Center for the Study of Free Institutions and the Public Good. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. And we've been talking a bit about Pride and Prejudice and the proud and difficult Mr. Darcy. And I do want to hear the very famous proposal scene. This is from the 1995 BBC television adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, of course, starring Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy. And he comes in to propose to Elizabeth Bennet. Let's hear that.
In vain I have struggled. It will not do. My feelings will not be repressed. You must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you. In declaring myself thus, I am fully aware that I will be going expressly against the wishes of my family, my friends, and I hardly need add my own better judgment. The relative situation of our families is such that any alliance between us must be regarded as a highly reprehensible connection. Indeed, as a rational man, I cannot but regard it as such myself, but it cannot be helped. Almost from the earliest moments of our acquaintance, I have come to feel for you a passionate admiration and regard, which, despite all my struggles, has overcome every rational objection, and I beg you most fervently to relieve my suffering and consent to be my wife.
And I do think my two guests just melted away, so I'll give them a moment to recover.
You're ready to say yes.
That scene still gets you every time, doesn't it?
Well, you know it's coming. Elizabeth is going to rip him apart.
We'll hear that in a moment. But talk about what Darcy does here. He says, I love you, but. What's the but? What does he tell Elizabeth?
Well, see, this is a really good example of Austen's nuance. Because what is it about Elizabeth and her family that makes Darcy hold back? Is it because she's of a lower class? You know, Darcy is actually not technically aristocracy. Mm-hmm. His mother is a sister of Lady Catherine.
They're the daughters of an earl, I think.
Right. Yeah. But his father was not titled, and he is not titled. But he's still as upper class as you get in Pride and Prejudice. Elizabeth is just part of the gentry. So she's not a commoner, but she's definitely not really aristocracy. So she's lower class and also has really no money, and he has $10,000 a year. And so is it money? Is it sort of a false pride that's at work? Or is it the character of her family? Because the character of her family really is problematic. Mm-hmm. Her mother is a silly twit. Her father neglects his daughters. And her three younger sisters are not to be admired all that much either. So And her cousin, Mr. Collins, is just the buffoon of all buffoons in novels, I think. And so is he speaking the truth? Is it a genuine pride, a concern about character, or is it a false pride? I think that's the question Austen wants you to deal with.
Deborah. You know, and it's obviously some of all of those things, because he says at the end of the book that he had been raised and taught to believe that he was better than other people merely because of what he was born into, and that he knows that in some sense that was the wrong thing to be taught. But he's not wrong in pointing out the ways in which the behavior of Elizabeth's family is reprehensible, or at least socially unacceptable. And Elizabeth eventually realizes that he has a point there, and that's what's coming in the next scenes after this one are very pivotal scenes for Elizabeth's growth and self-development, when she kind of is forced to confront the justice in his critique of her family, even as she rejects some of the snobbery that he embodies.
Let's hear the rejection first, because I think that's the comeback. So Darcy has said his piece. He says, "Will you marry me despite the fact that really your family is terrible?" And here is Elizabeth's response.
"You're mistaken, Mr. Darcy. The mode of your declaration merely spared me any concern I might have felt in refusing you had you behaved in a more gentlemanlike manner. You could not have made me the offer of your hand in any possible way that would have tempted me to accept it. From the very beginning, your manners impressed me with the fullest belief of your arrogance, your conceit, and your selfish disdain for the feelings of others. I had not known you a month before I felt you were the last man in the world whom I could ever marry."
"You have said quite enough, madam. I perfectly comprehend your feelings. And now I've only to be ashamed of what my own have been. Please forgive me for having taken up your time, and accept my best wishes for your health and happiness."
And off he goes.
But not for long.
Not for long. Now, you know this by heart. Both of you are talking along. So what is Elizabeth saying here? This is like the quintessential Elizabeth in many ways.
This is an incredibly brave thing that she does here, because her family's economic situation is such that once her father dies, they will literally be homeless. His house is entailed on their cousin, Mr. Collins. Mr. Collins is at this point married to somebody else, and they're going to be on the streets if these daughters don't marry somebody who is in a position to take care of their family. Mr. Darcy is not just in a position to take care of their family. This is like Kennedy-level wealth that he's offering her, and she is saying she won't do it because she doesn't love him and she doesn't approve of the way that he's talked about her family. And that's really, really courageous. And the fact that she's willing to do that is an incredible sign of what kind of person she is.
So again, it speaks to her character, Colleen Sheehan.
Well, she's courageous. As she once said, "My courage always rises with every attempt to intimidate me." She is courageous, but she's also wrong. She's totally mistaken, I think, about Darcy's character. She thinks he's done two things that are morally unacceptable to her. He's pulled Bingley away from her sister Jane simply because of he thinks Jane isn't good enough for some reason, and he's mistreated Wickham. The latter is not true, and the former, he's afraid for Bingley that Jane actually isn't interested in him, and we learn in the novel why that's the case. But I think Deborah and I wouldn't see quite exactly eye to eye on Elizabeth's rejection, because I don't think it's that that she's forced to learn that her family the truth about her family. I think she knows the truth about her family. She knows the failings in the Bennett family. She is misunderstanding Mr. Darcy because she's seeing him to a great extent through the lens of Wickham.
Okay, you're right. You're right.
And also because of her own pride, because she says she would care less about his pride had he not mortified hers. And so there's a battle of pride and a battle of wills going on, and I think she's not seen clearly. So I think there really still is a question of whether Darcy has the failings anywhere near close to what others think he has. I think, for the most part, he's exonerated in the end.
Right. For the most part, but I mean, he has not behaved well in the Jane and Bingley situation.
Let's take a quick call because somebody wants to weigh in on this. We have Nancy on the line at 1-888-477-9499. Again, our number is 1-888-477-9499. Welcome, Nancy, to Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm enjoying your conversation so much. I just want to say that Pride and Prejudice I encountered when I was in my early teens, and I think a lot of people did. And Elizabeth was one of two literary characters who, as a growing young woman without a lot of confidence, really gave me inspiration. I really felt like she had a lot of courage, and she stood up and said what she thought, even if it wasn't the most proper or popular thing to say at the time. And it really made me believe that I could be powerful too, and that what I thought did matter, and that I was entitled to have an opinion, and I was entitled to express it. And in many times over the years, I've read that book, reread it. Every couple of years, I pick it up. And like your guests, I do find new nuances. And over time, it taught me a lot about women in society, in history. I still think about, you know, what women's options were. And I think in another book, you know, Jane Austen comments in, through one of her characters, we don't have a lot of choices. The only thing we can hope for is a good marriage.
Yeah.
And it really did inspire me to think about women and our power and our place in society.
Thank you so much for that call, Nancy. We also received a comment on Twitter from Escribana7, who says, as a young woman, if I could choose to go back in time, it would be the Victorian era because of Jane Austen. So this came in at Twitter. We're at WHYY Radio Times if you want to weigh in that way. But this was not, as I think Nancy just alluded to, this may seem all very romantic and maybe one could think, oh, if only I had Mr. Darcy and if only I lived on this beautiful place. But this was not a great time for women on many levels.
Well, I mean, compared to what? I mean, compared to now, no. I mean, I'm not going back there anytime soon. Antibiotics alone is enough to keep me in the 21st century. But, you know, compared to what went before, I think, you know, England in the early 19th century is probably not the worst place for women. But certainly by our standards, you know, married women couldn't own their own property. Women had no rights to their children in the case of a divorce. I mean, there were a lot of things that, and, you know, there were really very few respectable occupations for a middle-class woman except for marriage. And, you know, these things are not very attractive to us, no question.
You know, and I think that Elizabeth is a woman for all times, really, mm-hmm. because as Nancy said, and that was lovely what Nancy said, mm-hmm. I mean, to read a novel and for it to make a difference in your life. You know, Jane Austen was a true teacher. She teaches us something about the arts of life. And but Elizabeth not only shows us courage and power, she shows us what it means to stand up for what you believe in and to be a woman of character. And I think that's partly why we love Austen still today, because there's a part of human nature that's unchanging. And we all have something to learn from those sort of shining individuals, whether in fiction or in real life.
And Deborah, the books speak to a wide variety of readers, but is it mostly women that Austen speaks to? Well, you lived among the Janeites. So.
I am a Janeite, so of course.
Sure.
I mean, in the 21st century in the United States, the fandom is pretty heavily female, that's true. But that has not always been the case. Jane Austen's first fans, and sort of like in the late 19th, early 20th century, when her fandom really kind of got going, which is considerably after her death, but that's when people sort of start to rediscover her. A lot of her fans were male, and in fact, to some extent, scholars have written about this, she was perceived as being kind of tough and therefore masculine, you know, not a sort of sweet little old lady writer necessarily. So there's been kind of an ebb and flow of views about whether she was more appropriate for women or for men. But certainly it's true that the contemporary fandom and the fandom people tend to read about in the newspaper when people go to Jane Austen conventions and there's lots of dressing up and that kind of stuff, that tends to be pretty heavily female.
But she speaks to women who would describe themselves as feminists. She speaks to women who are very traditional.
Yeah.
How do you think that is, both of you? Deborah,
well,
let's start
I
with
mean,
you.
The thing that I found most interesting in researching my book was the extent to which people tend to find something of themselves in Jane Austen, no matter how different they may be. So I interviewed a speech therapist who thinks that Jane Austen wrote about autistic characters. She's someone who counsels a lot of autistic people, works with a lot of autistic people, and she thinks that many of Jane Austen's characters are portraits of people with autism. I talked to, you know, fundamentalist evangelical Christians who think that Jane Austen really upholds biblical values, and I talked to people who, as you said, think that she's a radical, has a radical feminist message. And so I think that the reason we find so much in Jane Austen really is because there's an awful lot there. And so you can find a lot of different aspects of things that you're interested in, because she really had, as Colleen started out by saying, a very nuanced view of human beings. And there are a lot of shades of meaning there. Just on the biblical thing, I mean, obviously, she's writing about a world in which premarital sex was frowned on for both sexes and especially for women, and that's not the case in our 21st century American world, and some people really wish that it were. And so when they're reading these stories, they find something very appealing about that.
Colleen, do you want to weigh in on that?
I think Deborah said it as well as it could be said.
You just brought up something. Is there sex in Jane Austen's books?
There is plenty of sex in Jane Austen's books. There's not on-stage sex in Jane Austen's books. But, I mean, people who haven't read her in a while may have forgotten there's adultery, there's elopement, there's a duel in one of the books. And there's certainly a deep understanding of sexual attraction between men and women. I mean, if you read, I think Pride and Prejudice is a very sexy book. I think the conversations between Elizabeth and Darcy are very flirtatious and sexy, and you get a sense of what that rapport is going to be like between the two of them later, after the book is over.
There's some mystery.
Yes. But I mean, there are no 50 Shades of Grey type 20-page sex scenes. That's
right,
for sure.
Right, of course.
But no, she knows the meaning of obscene, which means off stage. The obscene is actually obscene. It's left off stage.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to, you spoke earlier how Jane Austen hits on so many of the big themes in our lives of what is love, what is friendship. How about bigger questions of what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is bad? Do you find that in her work, Colleen Sheehan?
Absolutely, Mikan. Mm-hmm. I mean, her novels are moral novels, but they're not in your face, and there's no finger pointing. I think she was a reader of Shaftesbury. We don't know for sure, but Shaftesbury once said something like, the world will be taught, it will not be tutored. In other words, to teach things like right and wrong and moral things, it can't be done through lecturing. It has to be self-discovery. Mm-hmm. And Austen is the master at setting before us scenes in which we can discover ourselves. It's the same as the Socratic method, the idea of coming to know thyself. Coming to know thyself means coming to know what it means to be human, and therefore what it would mean to live our lives in such a way that we might be happy. And that's all through all of Jane Austen's novels. I mean, look at Emma, how in her novel Emma doesn't know herself at all. Mm-hmm. Emma thinks she knows herself and everyone else, and knows how everyone else should live, and she directs them. But Emma has to make so many mistakes before she finally comes to see and to understand something about herself. In fact, she has to go through not just mistakes, but she has to be ashamed of her own actions. And so Austen doesn't lecture us. She presents to us Emma. Mm-hmm. And we have to decide what we think about Emma.
And what do we know? You mentioned some of the influences on Jane Austen herself. What do we know about her education, what she read, who taught her? How did she learn how to write so well?
We don't know anywhere near as much for sure as at least I'd like to know. We know her father had an extensive library, over 500 volumes, and you know Jane Austen was in that library and probably read every one of the volumes, at least that was worth reading. Mm-hmm. In fact, Elizabeth Bennet says in Pride and Prejudice, and I think this is sort of Austen talking herself, when Lady Catherine de Bourgh is grilling her, did you have an education? Did you go to London and study with the masters? No, Elizabeth says. Did your mother teach you? Elizabeth says no, but she says, we had all the masters that were necessary. Now, what does she mean by that? I think she meant that they had books. Mm-hmm. Because in the good books and books that are worth reading, we can find good teachers. And I think that's maybe what Jane Austen did.
We're about to take a break here. We're talking with Colleen Sheehan and Deborah Yaffe. Yaffe has a new book, Among the Jane Knights. It's a journey through the world of Jane Austen fandom. We'll get to more of that in just a moment. And Colleen Sheehan is an Austen scholar and also a professor of politics at Villanova University. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back after a short break here on Radio Times.
The University Museums at the University of Delaware support WHYY and present Hozinger and Clark, Boxes, Combs, and Constellations in Mechanical Hall Gallery. Transforming commercial packaging into clouds and cities and plastic homes into luxury weaves, artists Marin Hassinger and Sonia Clark use the ordinary to create the extraordinary. Open to the public Wednesday through Sunday, now through December 8th. More at udel.edu/museums.
A new biography of Charles Manson shows how this cult leader and killer borrowed from the teachings of pimps, Dale Carnegie, Jesus, Scientology, and the 60s counterculture to make young women follow him and fear him. We'll talk with Jeff Gwynn, author of Manson. We'll also hear Manson sing an original song and hear the Beach Boys version. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A sudden loss of innocence.
I wanted to believe it was going to be over soon, that it was a robbery, or maybe they'd let me go when they realized that it was not going to be over quickly.
A world traveler recounts the horror of her imprisonment by captors in Somalia and what the mind has to do to keep the body alive. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about Jane Austen and the 200th birthday of Pride and Prejudice. We are in the studio with Deborah Yaffe. She has a new book called Among the Janeites, A Journey Through the World of Jane Austen Fandom, and also with Colleen Sheehan from Villanova University. She is an Austen scholar and also professor of politics. And we are hoping to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. We got a question from Twitter, and one of the people said, which biography of Jane Austen do you prefer if you want to learn more about Jane Austen?
Well, I'm a fan of Claire Tomlin's biography of Jane Austen, which I think is about 10 years old or so, maybe a little more. Just a very well-written, good, you know, version of her life. But there are many, many to choose from. So you really, there's a lot of good ones. You can't really go wrong.
Colleen?
Yeah, I think that's right. And Park Honan did a one that's well-respected. And there are a lot of them. I mean, there's so much material out there on Jane Austen, even if you work in this area. It's hard to read it all.
Now, Deborah, I do want to talk about your book, Among the Janeites. And one of the chapters is devoted to the Regency gown, to the kind of outfit one maybe could wear when one is a big fan of Jane Austen. So what exactly is a Regency gown?
Well, I mean, this was one of the sacrifices I made for research, was that I felt like I needed to immerse myself in the dress-up part of Janeite culture, which is really something that I'm not into in my regular life. So the basic look in Jane Austen's period is a very high-waisted gown. The breasts get pushed up almost to your chin, basically, and then the waistline is right below that, and then it falls kind of straight down from there and goes all the way down to the ground. So it's a look that is not flattering to many of us, including myself. But I did have a gown made, and I had a corset made to create the proper Regency silhouette under the gown. So this is one of my adventures. And then I wore it to the ball of the Jane Austen Society of North America, which has an annual conference that culminates in a big ball.
And at the ball, do you do the kind of dancing that we see in the BBC mm-hmm. version?
Absolutely. In fact, at the ball that I went to, we were taught one of the dances that occurs in that BBC dramatization in a particularly pivotal moment. So, yes, we do the dances of the time and of the movies.
And when we say Regency, just to clarify that, Colleen Sheehan, what do we mean by that? What's the time period we're talking about?
Well, very loosely, it's the early part of the 19th century, or possibly even the end of Jane Austen's time is the end of the 18th, early part of the 19th century. She lives until 1817. But technically what it means is when the Prince Regent is in power. And we fought the American Revolution against King George III. King George III actually goes mad. And when he does in 1811, his son, who will become George IV, but in the meantime is the Prince Regent, takes power. And so until King George III dies, which is 1820. So 1811 to 1820 is technically the Regency period. And by the way, Jane Austen dedicates her book Emma to the Prince Regent, because She's not forced to, but she's told. She's told by the prince's the prince regent, of course, is the Prince of Wales, the person next in line to the throne, and she's told by the prince regent through his librarian James Stainier Clark that she is at liberty to dedicate her next book to him. Anyway, it's a very interesting little scenario that develops, and I've always wondered, because she hated the prince regent. He called himself the first gentleman of Europe, but he was anything but a gentleman. And she takes up that theme, in fact, in her novels, in Emma in particular. And he was a glutton. He was a gambler. He was a spendthrift. He was an adulterer. And she writes in one letter that she hates him. And I've always wondered if she ever got back at him. Knowing Jane Austen and her wit, you have to think that she might have. And in fact, she did. But that's another story, for the 200th anniversary of Emma in a couple years.
All right, we'll get back to that then. To go back to the balls, are there any men at these balls?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
what do they wear?
It must be said that the men are in the minority. It's yes. A little bit like your eighth grade dance in that regard. But yeah, there are men who are Janeites and are really into the dress up themselves, and then they wear the appropriate Regency attire for men of the time, which is usually like knee breeches and a cutaway coat and a fancy waistcoat underneath.
Or military garb.
Yes, some of them wear uniforms. So some of them are male Janeites, and some of them are just very long-suffering husbands and boyfriends who are kindly accompanying their partner to these events. But yeah, there are men.
And this dress-up is a big deal for some Janeites. For example, you describe a woman named Baronda Bradley. She is, I think, the queen of Jane Austen dresses.
Yeah, Baronda Bradley is a woman in Texas, really lovely lady, who is so into the dress-up aspects of things that she puts on her Regency gown for the Jasna conference when she leaves home to go to the airport to go to the conference. She wears it the whole time she's traveling, and then all 3 or 4 days that she's at the conference, and then all the way back home. So apparently she gets quite a lot of attention in airports as she walks along in her bonnet and her empire waist gown. But she has an extensive collection. She's got, I can't remember, 30 or 40 Regency gowns that she's had made for herself over the
expensive
years.
Expensive hobby.
It's expensive, but they're really, really beautiful, and she wears them beautifully, and has done a lot of research, historical research, on different looks and fabrics and accessories and things like that. And so she's somebody, this is the way that she connects to Jane Austen. So,
in your book, it seems like you describe a certain kinship among Jane Austen fans, but then also the desire of each person to have Jane to herself. Mm-hmm. At one point, you're walking somewhere and you're saying, "Ugh, I wish there weren't so many Jane Austen fans," because it's crowded and you think, what do all these people want here? So describe that tension a bit.
Yeah, this might be a tension that's inherent in any fandom, I think. On the one hand, it's really lovely to have all these people who share your enthusiasm. So you have this community of people who understand why it matters that Elizabeth should turn down Mr. Darcy, as opposed to thinking that that's some trivial matter that nobody cares about. You have all these people who understand on a deep level why this is really important. But on the other side of that, part of what is fun about being a fan is feeling like you understand the specialness of this wonderful thing in a really deep and individual way, that's what makes you special also, because you can relate to this amazing thing. You're this kind of connoisseur. So there's a tension between that sense of specialness and individuality and connoisseurship and that feeling of community. And so, you know, in the Jane Austen community, you get a little bit of sniping about the people who really only know the movies and don't really know the books. or those academics who are constantly sucking all the joy out of reading with all their footnotes. Or I gather the academics have somewhat jaundiced view of the people who are dressing up and talking about what would happen if characters from different novels ran into each other and things like that that are very not academic. So, you know, there are those tensions. But we all get along in the end, I would say.
How do you know if you're a Janeite? What makes you a Janeite?
Well, I would never define that in any particular. Okay. I mean, I wouldn't define it in any way that excluded anybody. I would say if you feel like you're a Janeite, then you are a Janeite. But I mean, I think of it as being somebody who feels a really intensely personal connection to these books or to this author. She's not just another writer that you read in high school English class. She's somebody that you feel a really intense connection with.
And Colleen Sheehan, you're a Janeite, obviously.
I guess, Mikan. I don't know.
Of the academic persuasion.
I appreciate her work and her art, and so if that makes me a Janeite, then I am. But I don't own any Regency gowns.
Well, never say never. And in Among the Janeites, Deborah, you describe there's a whole market of Jane Austen follow-up literature people trying to keep Jane Austen going. What are some of the books out there?
Well, there's different types of fan fiction. You might loosely call it fan fiction. I mean, there's books where people write sequels to Jane Austen's novels, what Elizabeth and Darcy's marriage is going to be like after Pride and Prejudice is over. There are people who write retellings of the novels from somebody else's point of view. There's a bunch of versions of Pride and Prejudice told from Mr. Darcy's point of view, for instance. And then there's people who write kind of modern updates of the novels, where you take the same basic characters and situations, but you put them into some kind of contemporary setting. So there's Fitzwilliam Darcy rock star, for instance, or there's a version of Pride and Prejudice that's set among evangelical Christians in Texas, and one that's set among lawyers in California, and all this kind of thing. So there's a huge, huge array of these things, and I think maybe the waves crested a little bit, but a couple years ago, I never could walk into my local Barnes & Noble without finding like seven of them on the new fiction table. And people, I think, Jane Austen only wrote six books, they're not that long, and the characters come to seem very real to those of us who love them, and it's just very upsetting when you realize there aren't any more of them, and you have an appetite for more of it, and there are people feeding that appetite.
And Colleen, the language, I'm imagining some of the newer books are written in a different language, and you are very much in touch with today's students. Do they have any barriers with Jane Austen's language? Is it difficult for them to read it? Are they obviously used to a different way of talking? And maybe sometimes it's hard to understand what the characters are saying.
Absolutely. For many of them at first, it seems a bit foreign. It's interesting because I sometimes teach a class in politics and literature that's actually focused on Jane Austen and then on some of the things that I think might have been influences on her way of thinking. And when they find out that Clueless, the movie, was patterned on her novel Emma, they're so excited because they think Clueless is a superior form of art. And so then the novel Emma becomes more interesting to them. And so I do find that. But once they sort of get used to it, it's a little bit like, not quite as difficult, of course, as Shakespeare, but it's like reading Midsummer Night's Dream. You know, when you come to know the characters in it, Cobweb and Puck and so on, and you come to love them, then all of a sudden the language doesn't matter anymore. It's about things that you care about.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you describe a very famous Janeite, maybe the richest Janeite, Sandy Lerner. Mm-hmm. And she's had a big impact on Jane Austen's legacy and on what people are able to see and touch and do with her work. Yes. Who is she?
So Sandy Lerner was one of the founders of Cisco Systems. So she made an extraordinary fortune in the late 80s, early 90s in Silicon Valley. And she is somebody who'd also loved Jane Austen since she discovered her when she was a graduate student. And so she learned that a stately home in England called Chawton House, which had been the home of Jane Austen's one of her older brothers, Edward Austen Knight. Chawton House was by that point a kind of falling apart wreck of an old house. And Sandy Lerner bought it and renovated it and has turned it into a library for the study of early English writing by women. And she donated to it her own very extensive collection of these very rare books. And I have been there and visited it. It's an extraordinarily beautiful renovation, and I gather a really great scholarly resource as well. So she really is owed a great debt by Janeite. She's kind of a Janeite heroine.
And you did a trip. You did a whole Jane Austen trip. What was that like?
So, yeah, the summer of 2011, I took the Jane Austen Society of North America has an annual tour of Austen sites in England, and I went on that as part of the research for the book. So first of all, it was an unbelievably fun way to do work. So I've never had a more enjoyable business write-off on my taxes before. But so we went to a lot of places.
Don't let the IRS know that.
So we went to a lot of places that Jane Austen had lived during her lifetime. We went to places that are important in her novels, and we also went to places where movies of the novels have been filmed. So it was a great range. And on this trip were a couple, I guess it was about 30 of us, hardcore Janeites. And we, of course, had a wonderful time talking about the novels and Jane Austen's life and our love of Jane Austen. And it was really a wonderful trip.
And did you feel any closer to Jane Austen, the person? Did you feel you learned things about her?
I think you learn some things that you can't necessarily exactly put into words. But, you know, we went to Steventon, which is the village in England where Jane Austen was born and lived for the first 25 years of her life. And it was a village of about 200 people when she grew up there, and it's still a village of about 200 people. The house that she grew up in isn't there anymore, but the church where her father was the minister is there. And we went there, and you stand in this churchyard, and there is not a sound. It is a completely rural environment. Unless a car happens to go by on the road, there's nothing except birds and the wind. And I think that, you know, that's a world that a lot of us don't live in anymore. And to kind of feel that, what it's like to be in that kind of rural setting, does give a context to Jane Austen's novels that maybe you couldn't get in another way.
And Colleen, have you done any of that kind of traveling? Jane traveling?
Well, I haven't been to the places you just described, Deborah, but I have been to Bath and to the places where she set Persuasion there, the Octagon Room, the Bath, and so on. And also, I once took a trip to Box Hill to try to discover, and it was a very interesting trip. I wrote a little article about it called It's a Topsy-Turvy World, because I discovered all kinds of things on my little visit there. It was quite an adventure.
And we received another tweet from Miss Amazing Forever, who sent us her favorite Austen quote, which is, "I am no bird, and no net ensnares me. I'm a free human being with an independent will." Love this quote. So this is a quote that she, like both of you, are puzzled, so we'll have to...
Because I think it's from Jane Eyre. I think she's confused. I'm pretty sure it's from Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. But it's a wonderful quote.
I'm pretty sure it's not a Jane Austen quotation.
Sorry, I thought it sounded like...
but it's lovely.
It is lovely. Do you have Jane Austen quotes that you live by in closing?
Oh, my, Mikan. For what do we live but to make sport for our neighbors and laugh at them in our turn?
That's a good one. That I live by. I don't know if I could say that I live by it, but
or that you love.
Yeah, Captain Wentworth's letter to Anne Elliot at the end of Persuasion is probably my favorite passage in all of Jane Austen, which begins, one of its early lines is, "You pierce my soul." That's one it's hard to forget.
And we see, I guess, the enduring legacy of Jane Austen. We see it in so many aspects. We see those quotes resurface. We see her characters in new movies, in new films. And I want to thank both of you two for coming here and bringing Jane Austen and all her work a little closer to us today. We've been talking with Colleen Sheehan. She is a professor of politics at Villanova University and a Jane Austen scholar. Thank you for joining us. And also with Deborah Yaffe. She has a new book, Among the Janeites, A Journey Through the World of Jane Austen Fandom. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. And our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and I thank you for listening to Radio Times.